Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Today, we are going to have on a guest that has been on once before, and he has told his story, which was very interesting, and it was very sad, because we have so many people like himself that has gone through so much. So we're going to have the honor of welcoming back our guest today, Jeffrey Deskovic, an individual who was sentenced to prison as a juvenile for a crime he did not commit, and 17 years later, exonerated. Following his long overdue release, Jeffrey Deskovic went to college. He earned his degree in criminal justice and eventually became a successful lawyer for wrongfully convicted individuals in the state of New York. Although he did not stop there, he is also founder of the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation of Justice, which has freed 11 people. Jeffrey additionally is an advisory board of the National Coalition Group, It Could Happen to You, which has helped pass 6 additional laws. And he serves on the Global Advisory Council for Restorative Justice International. Jeffrey has made a big comeback for somebody that went into prison as a juvenile. And this happens all too often where people are wrongfully convicted. And some of them are not as fortunate as Jeff was eventually. But he suffered a lot because he lost his youthful years. So let's welcome again Jeffrey Deskovic. Jeffrey, are you on with us?
I am indeed. Thank you for that really warm welcome, and happy to be on the show again, Leona.
I want to thank you, Jeff, because your situation was really unique in a way, because so many people that have been sentenced to prison or wrongful convictions haven't made it. They didn't do a comeback like you did. And you have been so successful in everything that you have done, and I am so proud, and I know the audience will be proud after listening to your story. So please, take the lead.
Sure. So you want me to share the story then? So the year was 1989. It was in Peekskill, New York, Westchester County. It was the suburbs, population of approximately 25,000 people. Murders were pretty rare. So when this murder happened, it created an atmosphere of fear, rumor, paranoia. Parents were concerned with their own safety as well as the safety of their children. In high school, I was quiet. I was to myself. I didn't participate in a lot of organized sports. And this made me seem strange to the kids in the high school. In the course of the police investigation, they interviewed a lot of students from the school, and some of them told the police that they might want to speak with me. And that was how I got on the police radar. Another thing was that I was a sensitive teenager, and this was really my first brush with death, and I had an emotional reaction, and the police thought that it was suspicious that I would be that upset over, you know, the murder of a classmate, really, who I barely knew. Although, and if you look at it in a bigger context, I really wasn't all that much different from other people in the city of Peekskill. I mean, there was mental health facilities set up, or free mental health services set up for anyone who wanted to discuss what had happened, you know. So then lastly, there was the Peekskill police got a psychological profile from the NYPD, and, you know, purporting to have what the actual perpetrator looked like. And I had the misfortune of, matching that. So it was a type of reinforcing factor. So for about 6 weeks, the police played this cat and mouse game with me, in which half the time they would pretend like they needed my help to solve the crime, and the other half the time they would talk to me like I was a suspect. So whenever they would, like, push too hard and I would get afraid and I would want to get away from them, you know, that's when, you know, this junior detective helper theme was, utilized. You know, kids won't talk freely around us, but they will around you. Let us know if you hear anything. Stop in from time to time. They would ask me opinion questions and congratulate me that my opinions were correct. I came from a single-parent household. My father was never involved in my life in any aspect, and that intersected with the good cop, bad cop technique, in which one officer pretended like to be my friend. So in time, I began to look up to him as a positive adult male role model. I wanted to be a cop prior to being a teenager. That was a career I dreamed about having. And So this unexpected early opportunity to do this quasi-police work, along with my age, 16, was how they were able to pull the wool over my eyes. That's as to the absurdity that, you know, a 16-year-old would be able to assist in an active homicide investigation. So eventually they got me to agree to take a lie detector test. They told me they had some new information in the file. They wanted to share that with me. That would allow me to be more helpful to them. But first I would have to take and pass a lie detector test. And so the next day, rather than go to school, I went to the police station for the test. Because it was a school day, my mother and grandmother thought that I was in school, so they didn't call around looking for me. They had no idea that anything was wrong. And they, instead of giving me the lie detector test at the Peekskill Police Station, they instead drove me across county lines to the town of Brewster, which was in Putnam County, 40 minutes away. So that meant I was no longer able to leave on my own. I was totally dependent upon the police. I didn't have an attorney present. I was not given anything to eat the entire time I was there. There was three cops that came there with me from Peekskill, but then there was also the polygraphist, who was a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator. But he was dressed like a civilian. He never identified himself as law enforcement. He never read me my rights. So after the brochure, he gave me a brochure, a four-page brochure, which claimed to explain how the polygraph worked, but it had a lot of big words in it that I didn't understand. But then when I pushed past my own concern, I thought, well, I'm there to help the police, so what does it matter? Let's just get on with it. And from there, they put me in a small room, and he attached the polygraph machine to me, and then he launched into his third-degree tactics. So he invaded my personal space. He raised his voice at me. He kept asking me the same questions over and over again. And as each hour passed, my fear increased in proportion to the time. Towards the end, he said, "What do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the test result that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it." And that really shot my fear through the roof. And at that point, the officer who had been pretending to be my friend, he came in the room and told me that the other officers were going to harm me, but that he was holding them off but couldn't do so any longer, that I had to help myself. And then he said, you know, just tell them what they want to hear. You can go home afterwards. You're not going to be arrested. Being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, not thinking about the long term, just being concerned with my safety in the moment, I was in fear of my life. The fact that I didn't know where I was and that nobody else knew where I was either, that loomed quite large in my mind. I was overwhelmed emotionally and psychologically. It was the false promise. There was the threat. And, you know, I just took the out which he offered, and I made up a story based on the information which he had given me in the course of the interrogation. By the time it was all said and done, I had collapsed on the floor in a fetal position, crying uncontrollably. Obviously, I was arrested. I was charged with a murder and rape.
And you were just a child.
So, I was just a child. Yeah, I was 16.
Jeez.
And before the trial started, the DNA test result came in from the FBI lab, which showed the semen found the victim didn't match me. But rather than acknowledge they made a mistake, they continued to prosecute full speed ahead. In order to explain away the DNA evidence, the prosecutor got the medical examiner to commit fraud. So after the autopsy was done, like 6 months later, once the DNA didn't match me, he suddenly said that he remembered that he forgot to document medical evidence that he claimed showed the victim was promiscuous, which is what opened the door for the prosecutor to argue that that was how the DNA didn't match me and that yet I had still murdered and raped her, that she must have slept with someone else before that. Taking it a step. Yeah, he didn't try to. He taken a step further. He even mentioned another youth by name that he claimed had had this encounter with the victim, but he never tried to prove it. He never had a DNA test performed. He never called him as a witness. He just made the unsupported argument to the jury.
Mm-hmm. You were trusting someone that was deceiving you, and you didn't even realize it at the time. The police officer that you thought you could trust because he was treating you so well. So, Jeffrey, how long did you serve in prison before being exonerated?
I served 16 years in prison. I lost, along the way, I lost 7 appeals. I got turned down for parole because I maintained my innocence rather than expressing remorse and taking responsibility. Ultimately, I was cleared through further DNA evidence. The DNA data bank had been created, and it matched the so they took the DNA that didn't match me and put in the data bank, and it matched the actual perpetrator, whose DNA was only there because left free while I was doing time for his crime. He killed a second victim 3.5 years later, who was a school teacher and had 2 children.
Jeez. So when you finally was released, and you went to college, you got your degree in criminal justice and became a successful lawyer. And can you tell us, how did you become the founder of the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice as a result of all this, I'm sure? But what made you actually establish it, and how did you go about that, and what is it about?
Sure. So my first 5 years of freedom, I was an individual advocate. I was speaking across the country. I was a columnist at a weekly paper. I was regularly meeting with elected officials and you know, about policy issues aimed at preventing what happened to me from happening to others. And I was trading privacy for awareness. So I was doing lots of print, radio, and television interviews. But I wanted to be involved in exonerating people. And, you know, and as an individual advocate, the most I was able to do was kind of nibble on the edges. So, for example, there were times when lawyers representing clients who were wrongfully imprisoned that were seeking exoneration, they were having a court hearing. And so they wanted to put my name in the press release to try to get more media coverage, or they wanted me to show up in the court for the visual effect if the judge recognized me. The theory was that maybe him or her would look a little bit more carefully at the case. And sometimes they wanted me to pack the courtroom and, you know, with people, again, showing public support. And sometimes I wrote about cases in my capacity as a columnist, but, you know, that was all kind of nibbling on the edges. And, you know, I wanted to be more directly involved. And so once I received some financial compensation, you know, I decided to use some of the money to start the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. And so its purpose is to free the wrongfully convicted and to pursue policy changes aimed at preventing wrongful conviction. So it was kind of like a logical, but.
That was awesome. You got 11 people freed, which is really awesome. It's, you know, it's almost meant to be what you went through. And I know that you lost your youthful years, but you've helped so many people since then. So then again, you also became an advisory board member for the National Coalition Group, It Could Happen to You. And that as well has passed 6 additional laws. So can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Absolutely. I do consider that my purpose in the world is to do this work that I'm doing, you know, freeing people and to prevent this from happening, and with a strong secondary interest on the other justice reform issues. So yes, I do look at it like that. So in terms of It Could Happen to You Coalition, so I met the founder of it, Bill Bastic, shortly after he formed the group. And, you know, he asked me to serve on the advisory board, and my foundation joined the coalition. And, you know, it was a unique coalition that was and still is made up of exonerees, people falsely accused but acquitted, criminal justice reform organizations, whether their main, you know, focus was innocence or not, individual advocates, friends and family of people who allege they're wrongfully imprisoned, formerly incarcerated individuals and groups, non-traditional partners. So we have teachers union, we have hotel and restaurant, AFL-CIO, labor. You know, we take on everybody, you know, just everyday concerned citizens. And, you know, our theory of doing that, working together in having a statewide coalition, is, first of all, strength in numbers. It's harder for the electeds to ignore us that way. And then no matter who we're meeting with, we're always able to bring somebody, feature somebody early in that meeting. Hey, so-and-so, Leo, by the way, Leona is, she lives in your district, by the way, and she votes, you know, and he, this is what she has to say about this issue. So that was our theory in doing that, in forming the statewide coalition, rather than trying to work on a go-it-alone type of approach, which is what organizations used to do before. And we did also, and it was very hard to get things done that way. And we waged the 8-year battle, growing the coalition and building support for a Commission on Prosecutor Conduct, so an independent oversight board for prosecutors. We recognized that the prosecutor was the strongest player in the criminal justice system, and yet they had no oversight. And as a result of that, prosecutorial misconduct was out of control. It was a factor that was running through many of the wrongful conviction cases. And many people told us that we're wasting our time, that it wasn't politically viable. But after, at the end of 8 years, we did pass the country's first Commission on Prosecutor Conduct. We used the same coalition to gather many of the splintered organizations. And a year later, we passed discovery reform, which came to shift information sharing early and automatic in the process, whereas previously in New York, witness statements and evidence would often be turned over on the eve of a hearing or on the eve of a trial. And so now it has to be done automatically early in the process. And so building off of our success that way, having a statewide coalition and working that way, we formed a group in Pennsylvania. We picked Pennsylvania because I knew a lot of individual advocates and advocacy organizations in Pennsylvania that didn't necessarily know each other, didn't necessarily work together. And so that was how we came to pass. That was how we came to have that branch of the coalition. And we were able to pass the law in Pennsylvania pertaining to automatic expungement of records. So anybody who had been arrested for a crime and they ultimately won their case, whether they were acquitted, they were exonerated, a charge was dismissed, dropped, whatever, you were charged with a crime and you ultimately won your case, and that would automatically come off of your record. So now we're focusing in on exoneree compensation. So Pennsylvania is one of 13 states, one of 12 now, that does not currently offer compensation. So we're working at that. At passing that, we're building support. We've written the bill now, and we're just gathering support, looking for bill sponsors. And then we also did the same thing in California. So we have a Californian chapter. We're trying to export the Commission on Prosecutor Conduct there. In terms of my role in the coalition, so the founder has about like 40 years in politics, holding some elective office and offices and working as a staffer. So he's good at streamlining, following up, figuring out what tactics to engage in what order. My aspect of it is, you know, I'm more the lightning rod for the media. I'm the coalition's liaison to the exoneree community. So that's how we work together. We've been, you know, doing this now like 10 or 11 years together, and you know, the foundation and the coalition co-branding. And actually he works for me as a policy director while I'm also an advisory board member of his coalition. So I love working together. And look, there's a lot to trying to pass legislation. There's lots of follow-ups and discussing on bill language and all of that stuff. And yeah, I play a role to some extent, but not everything. Some things he just says, look, Jeff, I need you. We got to go here on this date, and here's our itinerary. Hey, Jeff, call the band. You know, just being in the group of exonerees in that particular state. So I love working together with them, and that's the purpose of working together. I mean, I remember during some key junctures when we were trying to pass the commission bill right towards the end, there were a couple of key press conferences, and I had finals, and I couldn't skip the final to go to the press conference. So I got on the horn with some of the other exonerees that have been working with us, and I said, look, you guys have been incredible. You've worked with me. You've spoken with me at press conferences. Right after I speak, you pile on. Look, I can't attend this one. I need you to step up for me, and, you know, next man up. And they went there and, you know, took care of it, and we got the job done. So, you know, spread the blows out, spread the work product out. I love working collaboratively. So that's the whole theory of working in coalition. So the coalition's founder, Bill Bastic, myself, and one other person, we're the only three people that are in common to the three groups. The rest are made up of stakeholders that live in that particular state.
I'm actually going to, I want to ask too about how your grandmother and your mother took it when you were incarcerated, but I want to bring up one more thing. You serve on the Global Advisory Council for Restorative Justice International, so you've actually started to go even beyond the United States of America. So can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Absolutely, sure. So I was asked by their president and founder, Lisa Ray, if I would serve on their Global Advisory Council. So my primary role there is, you know, I advise them on wrongful conviction issues, and I also advise them on broader criminal justice issues. So I kind of have to wear two hats. So when they ask about an issue, I first have to lay an issue out and all sides of it without referencing, you know, where I come down on something, and then they like me to then advise them what do I think the right position is and, you know, and why, and then they think about it as a group. So I kind of share that information to them. So that's part of my role there. RJI is not a non-for-profit, so they are able to endorse candidates, and I do bring political candidates to their attention that are running on a justice reform plank. I tell them, look, I think this person's good. I don't think we should endorse them. And again, they and I explain why, and they decide what they're going to do as a group. But I like working with them. I like working with them also. I mean, restorative justice certainly applies as to people that have been wrongfully convicted, you know, just on a societal level, just trying to, you know, make up for that, and certainly getting an apology, having compensation, exoneree reentry services. Those are some of the ways where, you know, society can try to restore exoneree who's been, you know, damaged to the experience, you know, try to get them back as restore them as much as you can, realizing the impact of it. So that's how I that's, you know, how I work with them. I've spoken at a number of conferences, including some in India, just online, and I've done work in the countries of Armenia and also Argentina. So I do have some international colleagues, and I like networking, and I'm kind of a people person. So I do like working with RJI, and I've done a number of podcasts with them, and sometimes co-interviewing people there on their podcast.
You have done so much. You've been such a role model for so many people I know that have gone through what you have gone through. And for someone that so young, 16 years old, and to serve that many years in prison on a crime you didn't commit, and for those particular crimes, you must have suffered an awful lot while being incarcerated. And I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
100%. Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you know, there's a vigilante mentality towards people who have been convicted of sex offenses. And, you know, I unfortunately was convicted of the rape along with the murder. So it was definitely a dangerous situation. I always had the fear in the back of my head people would discover what I was incarcerated for, and that could motivate them to, you know, assault me, cut me, try to kill me. I mean, anything was possible. And over the years, there were times I was beat up, and one time I nearly lost my life. And sometimes the guards would tell other prisoners, you know, what I was incarcerated for, hoping that, you know, put a battery in their back to go and try to harm me. So I mean that part of it was, difficult to say the least. But, you know, I also went by, you know, where I didn't get in trouble for anything, including, because when you defend yourself, then they consider that you were fighting. You know.
We're losing you. Running out, Jim.
I'm the only in general population. I wasn't in protection.
We're losing you. Can you hear us, Jeff?
I said I could. Yes, I can hear you.
Okay,
can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm hearing you now. It seems like you were going in and out for a minute.
Hello?
Okay, can you hear now? Jeff?
Hello?
Can you hear?
Here, can
you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. We were having a bit of difficulty hearing you for a minute.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was like a where I, so I'm not sure if that's, you know, part of it or not. But can you still hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so
now
what
you,
I was saying is that, yes, it was.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, I mean,
So you mentioned that the guards, the correctional officers would let the prisoners know what you were in for in hopes of some problems.
Yeah, that happens sometimes, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you started to say something, and we were having trouble hearing you. You kind of like went out for a minute. Can you repeat what you were talking about?
Yes, I was saying that there were times when I was frustrated that the guards would tell the other mates what I was incarcerated for. Hoping that they would do something.
And that still exists. Tell us about what was it your mother and your grandmother going through during all that time that this was happening after you went in? It must have been difficult for them as well.
Yeah. Jesus, that's connected.
We can hear you now.
Yeah. Hello.
Yes, we can hear you now. Can you hear us?
Yeah. I'm not sure. Should I hang up and just call back?
You might, if you want to do that, Jeff. That you can do that as well. It might come in clearer. Jeffrey is going to be calling back in. He's having a little difficulty, I think, with the phone. But what he's talking about, it's happening to so many others throughout the years, and so many people have committed suicide. So many people have gone through so much, and it continues to this day. So this is why I'm very, very appreciative that Jeffrey is coming on to talk about this, because this has to be told. His experience has to be told, and what he's done as a result is something that many do not get an opportunity to do. So he was determined when he came out to make his time in to make it not be in vain. So Jeffrey, are you back with us?
With you, yes.
Okay. So
yes.
Do you want to finish what you were talking about prior to that?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, but just I'm not hearing you very well. I mean, we just had
a
power outage, and
Go ahead, Jeffrey.
This call is not private. It will be recorded and may be monitored. If you believe this should be a private call, please.
Okay, do you want to finish? Can you hear us?
Say that again.
Okay, do you want to finish telling the audience about your story?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Yeah, what I was saying is that sometimes the guards would tell the other inmates what I was incarcerated for. They were hoping that they would, you know, do something to me. So it was, you know, it was a dangerous situation. You can still hear me, right, Leona? Oh, my God, man.
Okay, we can hear you, Jeff.
All right.
Go ahead.
So, in terms of you asked about my mother and grandmother, I mean, you know, they were certainly shocked that I was, convicted. They didn't expect me to be convicted because I was innocent, and they believed in my innocence, and they still believed in the justice system. My mother said that the most difficult part of this whole experience was when she would leave the prison, and then, you know, that she knew that she couldn't, she had to leave me there. She couldn't take me with her, you know, so that part of it was definitely difficult. And, you know, that she...
I think that's the worst thing for a parent or even your grandmother. I think it's the worst thing when they visiting the prison and not being able to take your loved one home with you, but even more so to know that your loved one is just hurting so badly because he or she wants to go home with the parent. So I know exactly what you're going through, and I know what your mother was going through, Jeff. And I know it was no picnic, especially being innocent of what you went through. I want to say one thing real quickly, and I've said this before on the radio show. The Christ Jesus, he ended up being crucified. He ended up being beaten by guards. He ended up being spit upon and shamed and humiliated and tormented and tortured. And he, too, was innocent. So people look at incarcerated individuals as though they're hardcore criminals. And I always say they should not stereotype, because no one knows the situation of the individuals that are behind those bars and those walls. And your example, Jeffrey, has been a pure example of exactly what I've always told the audience and told other people, not to stereotype. You've been through a lot, and you came out of it victoriously. And this is why I say you're a role model for so many people, and also an informative individual with so much wisdom. And I want you to keep talking about everything that is on your mind, how you felt, even experiencing traumas after coming out. Were you able to sleep at night? Did you end up with post-traumatic stress syndrome? Just tell us all about the experiences that you had to endure, even when you came out.
Sure. So when I came home, I did have post-traumatic stress disorder, panic attacks, anxiety. There were feeling of processing things at a slower speed, feeling of having been frozen in time. Certainly when I would see law enforcement, I would be fearful. So all of those were side effects. It was kind of an awkward experience when I would meet up with my extended family, because most of them had never come to see me, or had come to see me very sporadically. So they were strangers to me. So that part was difficult. The world was changed. Technology was different. Cell phones, internet, GPS hadn't been created yet. So between that and the culture being different and neighborhoods looking different, it felt like I was in a parallel world, one that I didn't belong to. There was a stigma. Yeah, I had been wrongfully imprisoned, yes, but I was there for 16 years. So how much of that rubbed off on me? And, you know, was it so safe to be alone someplace with me? So that certainly posed a challenge when it came to personal relationships. I was, like everyone, I was released without anything. I was able to pursue compensation, but that took 5 years. And so I wasn't provided any assistance from the state. So I was always passed over for gainful employment. So I lacked stability of housing. I bounced around from place to place. At one point, I was a couple of weeks away from being in a homeless shelter. And yes, I had a hard time. I had and still have a hard time sleeping. I used to have quite a bit of nightmares, and people would say, "Hey, you were fighting with someone in your sleep, or you must have been dreaming." I mean, you know, we could hear what you were saying. So there was some of that, and you know, just there's a lot of stimuli out in the world as compared to while you were incarcerated. So even just trying to catch up in terms of that, I mean, something as simple as just getting junk mail or recurring, you know, just monthly bills. I mean, that was something that took a while for me to get used to. But then there were other life activities. I mean, because of the fact that I was incarcerated from age 17 to 32, I had never had a license before. I had never lived alone. I never went shopping. I never had to write a check. I never had to balance a budget. So all of those things made it more of a challenge. I mean, I miss births, deaths, weddings, finishing education at a more traditional age, maybe being maybe having a family, maybe being on my way to a career. So there were a lot of challenges associated with being with having been wrongfully incarcerated. I mean, certainly the world was world was kind of lonely. I mean, all the people that I knew, I lost track of after and I had been arrested. They certainly didn't live around in any of the old neighborhoods that they lived. So it was kind of a lonely experience as well.
Jeez. You know, it's sad. It even hurts me just listening to what you had to go through at 16 years of age, you know. And we on the outside, well, you know now, but we on the outside, we see changes happening almost every few days. So, you know, in a week's time, a lot has happened from the beginning of the week to the end of the week. But from 16 and 16 years later, I know what it must have been like coming out to a completely different environment. Also, I wanted to ask, since you've been working with the wrongfully convicted, have you ever come across any cases or have you ever worked on any cases that were so similar to yours, going in as a juvenile and adolescent and spending all those years in prison before being exonerated?
I haven't had any clients that are the, well, actually, yeah, there's one, yeah, there's a client now that, you know, is similar, his name's Andrew Krivak, and the same polygraphist that coerced the false confession out of me did the same thing to him. You know, he claimed that way, way back before. So he's home now, but you know he's awaiting retrial, so the case isn't finished. So his case reminds me a lot of mine in that aspect. There's a client now, Omar Clark. I did my first oral argument in connection with his case, and you know we won a ruling that you know, from the judge that she's going to allow us to present our evidence of his innocence in a hearing. But he kind of reminds me of myself in a way. I mean, he wasn't quite as young, but still, he was, you know, he was in his young 20s, and he's been in for like 3 years now on a rape case. So I can relate to his being young and you know just being incarcerated wrongfully on a sex offense case. So you know, there's some ways. I mean, I haven't met somebody that was completely like my case on all fours. There was a prisoner named Frank Sterling that was incarcerated with me. Frank, though, was like about 10 years older than me, so we didn't really share the youthful aspect of it, but it was a false confession. And Frank and I kept each other going for 13 and a half years. I mean, once every 6 weeks we used to get together in the prison yard and we would start brainstorming about, you know, what was the next move to make. And we would talk about what were the latest court decisions that, you know, came down, what were the latest wrongful conviction books, what were the latest ideas of people and entities to write to looking for help. And ultimately, Frank was exonerated through DNA testing a couple of years after me. So it wasn't that I was naively believing that he was innocent, but, you know, we both actually were innocent.
Can you talk a little bit about the type of individuals that were incarcerated during the time you were? What they were like? Were, you know, a lot of people think that people incarcerated for any kind of crime is a hardcore criminal. But did you meet any? You must have met some good people while incarcerated, because we've heard so many times.
I met plenty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I met plenty of people that were good while I was incarcerated. There were a lot of old timers that some of them were literally living in honor block, and they, you know, other people were kind of serving as like role models for the younger prisoners. There were a few people that kind of put me under their wing and, you know, just explained some of the ropes, explaining some of the prison survival tactics, and you know just how to navigate prison life, not wasting your time taking programs that had, you know, where you learn something and it had some kind of potential benefit for the outside. There was another person that, you know, encouraged me to go to the law library and learn the law. There was a older prisoner there that helped me to learn how to do some legal research. So there were those people. There were people in there that were doing, I knew people that were doing like 10, 15, 20, 30 years just for drug possession, where they, you know, New York used to have the Rockefeller drug laws. I mean, they changed it, but the changes didn't impact everybody. But I saw people that had that kind of time for possessing a certain amount of drugs that was just over an arbitrary limit that separated something from being a misdemeanor, for which you would get a year or less, versus getting one of those 10, 15, 20, 30-year prison sentences. And a lot of those people had, they were doing more time than people that were there that had killed people. And that, you know, that looked backwards to me. And, you know, there was a floor that there was a tier in the cell block where prisoners were housed there on the bottom floor that had very serious medical issues. Some of them had dialysis treatments. Some of them were hunched over or walking with a cane or being literally pushed around in wheelchairs, while still others were simply living in the hospital on the prison grounds. And, you know, and the prison wasn't able to care for them. And I knew people that, you know, they were friendly. They played chess with me. They seemed to me to not be the same people that they were when they committed their crimes 10, 20, 30 years before, but yet they had another 5 or 10 years, you know, left. And it didn't seem to me like any good was going to come from their continued incarceration. The only thing that was going to happen is they were just going to get older. You know, I met some people that were pretty smart, that were artistic, some write books or could draw or could paint. Some were read a lot of books. And at the same time, there were unfortunately gang members there. And, you know, there were some people that, you know, I think should probably always be there. But that was kind of like the minority. I would say the majority of people in prison were not bad people. They might have made some poor decisions. They might have done crimes for which they should have been incarcerated for, they should be punished for. But at the same time, I wouldn't say, you know, they're this horrible, hardcore person that, you know, has no social redeemable value. And the second that they get released, you know, they're going to be, you know, killing or murdering or robbing. I didn't find it to be that way. I found that that was just a small percentage of the.
Yeah. And I've heard other prisoners have said the same thing. You know, the majority is good, but there are some that shouldn't get out. What I was going to say is, can you talk about the rehabilitation? Because I want to go back to what you were talking about with these elderly that should not even be in, because there's so many elderly in prison now that they can't even take care of themselves, never mind, you know, being hurting anyone on the outside. But that's, you know, they work on compassionate release. But can you talk a little bit about some of those issues too, and also the rehabilitation? Jeffrey, if you were to be a politician,
yeah,
and I hope someday that you will run for some political position, because you would make an excellent legislative member in leadership. And you, I would just like to have you talk about what would it be that you would tell these legislative members that can make these legal decisions in as far as the types of releases that should be, the types of rehabilitation. Can you just talk about that as well? Please do.
100%. Yeah, definitely. So definitely any serious talk about rehabilitation in the prison needs to begin with reintroduction of college education for prisoners. I saw the transformative effect that college education had on prisoners. I mean, people went from telling war stories about when they were running the streets and chasing money and, you know, which women they had and were dating to, instead like dreaming out loud of, you know, being a drug counselor or working with at-risk youth, trying to divert them from a life of crime, trying to divert them from ending up in prison. So college education, you know, it's obvious why college education benefits. It broadens horizons. It equips people for gainful employment. Next, I would go to vocational trades. So I completed many vocational trades, but while I did that, most of the curriculum was obsolete. So, for example, I completed the plumbing program. I did 6 certificates in plumbing, but almost all of the almost all the curriculum was like for iron and metal pipe. And now it's PVC pipe and copper. So if I decided that I wanted to try to have that career upon release, you know, I would have to start at the same exact place that I would if I had received no training. So I feel like updating the curriculum is one thing. I think that there should be testing of the prisoners in the vocational shops in order to ensure that the instructors are actually teaching, that they're not just there for a paycheck. While I felt that some were there to try to teach and make a difference, there were far too many people that I felt were just there for the paycheck. So I think that should be overhauled. I definitely think that the verbal abuse and non-professional attitudes of a lot of the correctional staff towards the inmates. I mean, that has to be cracked down on. Otherwise, I don't see how it's an environment that's conducive to rehabilitation. As far as I'm concerned, for the most part, any rehabilitation that takes place in the prison is despite the prison, rather than because of it. There was the RSAT program, so residential substance abuse and alcohol training. And I remember when they instituted that and they were getting – the Department of Corrections was getting federal funding, and that was somewhat of a racket. They would bring in a new cohort of inmates to take the program and live in that cell block, and it seemed like they would use the slightest excuse to kick people out of the program once they received the money. That way, you know, they guarantee to have a big another big class of people coming through getting more funding. As one person told me, you know, this is the block for people to get better from overcome their alcohol and drug addiction, but there's more dirty urine tests here than anywhere else. And another person commented, and I thought it was true. I mean, you're going to combine drug dealers, former drug dealers, with, you know, former drug users. What do you think is going to happen? And so that would be another thing that I would say in terms of, you know, rehabilitation, you know, removing people from programs on the slightest pretext or, you know, minor offenses of breaking various, whether it's a prison rule or a rule in that program. I don't think that's really conducive to rehabilitation. So many things just seem to lack basic respect, basic human rights. And, you know, one thing we know that community ties and visitation, that these are good indicators that prisoners will be able to make a successful reintegration back into society, leading a crime-free life. And yet, at least in New York, they house prisoners that are from the city. They're sent to prisons that are in upstate New York, and those that are from upstate New York are sent to the prisons that are closer to the city. And, you know, and that seemed backwards, and it seemed like in terms of visitor processing that the guard, in the course of the prison, in terms of the part of the visit processing, that it would seem to discourage. It would discourage people from coming back and visiting. And, you know, I think that's backwards as well.
I look at rehabilitation, and I often wonder why they don't. And I started a petition not about a year ago to replace prisons with long-term residential treatment facilities. And that, you know, would be long-term residential substance abuse treatment facilities, long-term mental health facilities. And there's like 669 signatures. But a lot of people, I think, believe that if they sign that petition, if it was to happen, a lot of the real serial killers and terrorists and all of them would be getting out. And it doesn't mean that at all. It means that they would be getting the treatment for as long as it took, whether in for the rest of their lives or less.
Right. You know, terrorists, people would, I mean, it would mean just that. If we're going to give mental health treatment, you'd give mental health treatment. A lot of prisoners there had mental health issues. I saw mental health treatment a few times just in terms of trying to deal with to being wrongfully incarcerated and just thoughts of depression. And, you know, and I was the mental health professionals that were working there, that they were so overwhelmed by their caseloads that they really only had time to treat people that were psychotic or were having hallucinations. They didn't have the capacity to treat people. I felt like the mental health staff, their answer to everything was medication. I felt like it seemed clear. I mean, I saw some people, they got better as they got off their meds. The medication seemed to be more having to in an orderly prison than it did actually trying to treat mental health issues that prisoners had. Some of the prisoners with mental health issues that were picked on or made fun of by the general public. And so I feel strongly that that population really should, you know, there should be some protections for them and other vulnerable prison population rather than being exposed to general population. But I want to go back to an issue you mentioned to me before. We talked about, you mentioned compassionate release. So, you know, that part really bothered me. So compassionate release is a vehicle by which prisoners who have been deemed by medical staff to be terminally ill, so you could apply for early release, with the theory being that you could die with some dignity, you know, with your family in a free environment, not in the prison visiting room. And often by the time a decision was made, there were times when the decision was made to grant compassionate release, and that came a day or two after the prisoner had died already. It took so long that they had like one or two days left. You know, and that just to me seemed, it just seemed cruel. It just seemed so wrong. If I could have screamed that, even on some facilities where they, you know, have a prison hospice. Really? Do we have to be that vengeful? Do we have to extract every last day of incarceration that someone's been sentenced to, even when they're terminally ill? Do we have to be, you know, that? When does it become mob rule? When does it just turn into, you know, revenge?
Exactly.
It's far beyond the pale of justice, you know, to me. I get angry just thinking about it. And the medical care was terrible in prison in general. I mean, the medical staff, their answer to everything was over-the-counter medication. There was a very disturbing story I'll quickly recall. There was a prisoner there known as, his last name was Sanchez. I remember we all called him Choco. He was his nickname, which is Spanish for chocolate, because his skin complexion was chocolate. So it was kind of like a nickname of endearment. So anyway, coming to the point, I knew Choco for maybe like 4 or 5 years, and I remember passing him by. We were walking on the ground floor in the prison, and we used to call that the flats. And he was walking very slowly, very laboriously, and I could see sweat coming from his forehead. And I said, "Hey, are you okay? You know, are you okay, man? You need any help? Maybe I think you should go to sick call." And he said that, he said, "I just came from there. I told them that my chest was hurting, but they don't believe me. They gave me Tylenols, and they told me to take them, and if I have pain in the morning, to come back. But I feel like I'm dying." And he was. He died of a heart attack that night in his cell. They found his body the next day.
Oh, geez. Yeah. I think, Jeffrey, we have 5.5 minutes. So what I wanted to ask you is if you can give the audience information to the Foundation for Justice, and also the information to the National Coalition Group, It Could Happen to You.
Yeah, 100%. So the foundation, we have a website, very user-friendly, www.deskovic.org, and there's a web form there. You know, you can learn more information that way. You could email me through that. We're always looking to raise money to increase our capacity so that we can work on freeing more people, so that we can work on passing more laws in more states. You know, it's not free to do this work. You know, I work, you know, 50, 60 hours a week. I don't get paid for it, but it's, you know, it's a labor of love. And, you know, I've gotten compensation, and it throws off a certain amount of income per month. So that serves in lieu of a salary. But, you know, I need to have other colleagues, you know, that are, you know, they're not in the same situation. They need to be able to make ends meet. And so hence the need to be able to raise money to pay salaries to people to help to pass more laws and to work on more cases. The coalition group, It Could Happen to You, you can Google them and Google the word Bill Bastic. There's definitely a website there. And we have what's called the Wednesday Watch on Injustice, and it's an online publication. Comes out every Wednesday, and we spotlight wrongful conviction, false accusation, and other justice reform issues. So you can it's free to subscribe to. And look, I want to just quickly hold up, you know, that there's some bills we're pushing for in New York pertaining to preventing wrongful convictions caused by false confessions. There's a bill that would prohibit police deception, recognizing that it's inherently coercive. There's a youth interrogation bill, which is a proposition that states that anyone who's 18 years old cannot waive their rights and speak to the police without first speaking to an attorney to advise them of their rights, recognizing that most people, myself included, you know, we really don't understand our rights, and that understanding is essential before you can waive it. Getting rid of the exceptions to the law that mandates police patients from beginning to bill pay.
We're going in and out again. Can you hear us, Jeff? Okay, we've lost him again. Jeffrey, I don't know what's going on, but we have 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes left. I don't know if you can call back in again, or if you can, whatever's going on. But I want to thank Jeff for coming on, because he has been very informative. But I also want to remind the audience that Jeffrey's story is not an isolated incident or situation. But what he did with that experience that he went through, he did so much good with it. He came out, he got his degree in the criminal justice area. He became a lawyer for the wrongfully convicted. He started the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. He's been on the advisory board for the National Coalition Group. He serves on the Global Advisory Council for Restorative Justice International. And as he says, if you can, try to support his foundation, because what he has done has been extraordinary. And I am so proud of what this young man had came out of prison and ended up achieving throughout those years. And what he says about the people that oversee in the prisons, we have heard this so many times about the injustices that go on. We have heard so many things about the people that have either committed suicide or died from other results of neglect or abuse by the penal system. And we have someone that's calling in. We have about 30 minutes. You want to state your name, please?
Hello, yeah, my name is Benjamin. I'm calling from Ghana.
You're calling from quite a distance. Benjamin, I'm sorry to say, we're getting ready to close the studio now. So if you'd like to call in again, we're going to have try to have Jeffrey Deskovic back on with us again, if you'd like to call back at another time. But if you have something quick to say, you have about 50 seconds left if you'd like to say something.
Oh, I want to say is that I enjoy the program. I've been following the program from Ghana, and I enjoy the program, and I've learned a lot. So I just want to say.
Well, thank you so much for calling. I can see the number 233 is coming all the way from abroad. I thank you for calling in, and I do ask, and I will let everyone know when Jeffrey will be back on with us. But you can check in from time to time with blogtalkradio.com/sheddinglight, and it will have all the series coming up, all the people that are coming up on the show. But I am going to, and unfortunately, Jeffrey, we can't hear him right now, but we're going to ask him if he will be willing to come back on because he is very informative. And I want to thank you for calling in as well.
Okay, thank you, too. Okay.
Do you want to, real quickly, do you want to state, you had, I believe you mentioned at one point in time that I had spoken with you or messaged with you that you have a school, that you do something with the children at the school?
Yes, yes, I have to, we educate children at school and then we try to help them in their, with their school suppliers and other things. Actually, I represent a foundation called Yahweh Save Life Foundation Ghana. And we provide humanitarian support to needed children in schools.
What is the name of it?
The name is Yahweh Save Life Foundation Ghana.
Okay,
Yahweh
Life
Foundation Ghana.
If you would like to come on the show sometime, send me a message or an email, and it I am on Messenger, and it's under Leona Brando,
okay.
Brandao, and then maybe we can schedule something for you to come on the show.
Okay,
thank you. We are now going to be closing this episode. And Jeffrey, I know that you're still on with us, but we can't hear you. So I will try my best to get in contact with you later so that we can reschedule for you to come on again. And I enjoyed having you on, and I thank everyone for listening in. And again, we will be having our guest back on, and we will be having our friend from Ghana, West Africa, coming on with us as well to talk about his school. Thank you all, and we will be closing this episode now.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.